No sound.
No sound.
No sound. No sound.
It's all sound. CD1.
How about you, Patty? You got any?
Oh, wait a minute.
Oh. And good.
There we are.
Sorry.
Am I coming across?
There you are. Yeah. Now you are.
Okay, I'm not coming across.
You are, but I'm not.
Oh, okay. No, you are for me. Okay.
Okay.
That's great. This is Kanawin. Good morning and welcome to Lambda Weekly, the world's oldest and longest running gay
community radio.
Right. Our guest is getting a kick out of us. Welcome to Lambda Weekly, the world's oldest, longest running gay and lesbian radio show.
Anywhere in the world, as far as we know.
Well, that would make it the world's... if it's the world's longest, it would be anywhere in the world, I guess. So, good start once again to... since we moved to Sundays, we're a mess.
It's cranking down the year, mm-hmm. So you're right here at the end. Mm-hmm. So we can.
I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here in the studio with Laurent Landis and the late Patty Fink. Our guest today is Dr. John Carlo. He's the new executive director of AIDS Arms. Raylene Nobles was our guest lots and lots of times. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Raylene did was she expanded care just beyond the arms to the legs and the whole body, and it became a full... what AIDS Arms really became, medical care became the main focus. It wasn't really before she was there. And so when they replaced her after she retired, Dr. Carlo is the new head of the agency, and we
the head of the arms.
The head of the arms.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd talk about all kinds of HIV stuff today, just to put it in technical terms. Well, welcome.
First,
welcome.
Thanks. Thank you for having me come aboard. And yes, it was a delight to replace Raylene. I'd been on the board of AIDS Arms for a while, and I've known Raylene for many, many years, and it was just a delight to. It's been a year now, but just a delight to be taking her place.
Yeah, I can't believe it's a year because Raylene would come on like twice a year or so, mm-hmm. just talking about all the stuff going on there. But I guess it is that long.
Yeah, it goes by fast. It started in December, and it has been a good year. And already in this year, we've had a lot of changes, particularly around healthcare and healthcare reform. So, I hit the ground running, that's for sure.
Well, this is one of those questions. We didn't even think about this ahead of time. Now that you mentioned that, how is healthcare reform going to affect the agency?
Well, it's going to affect the agency a lot. I think it's going to affect everyone in this community now that there are more options around the marketplace. And, unfortunately, the website did not roll out as good as it probably could have. I think we could have predicted that given the slice of pie that they were going to try to assume mm-hmm. with that large of a components with the website. But it's starting to get better. And I personally was able to get on and get my insurance signed up last week. So I've been trying since October. So if I could do it, it's getting better. but I'd say that health insurance is incredibly complicated. Mm-hmm. We all roll through our benefits. If we're with our employers or if we're in the individual market, we know how complicated it is with copays, deductibles, premiums, and all of that. This is even more complicated because once you get on that website, you have to figure out your income, how much you're going to make for 2014, and so you're basically looking at your taxes and your health insurance at the same time. It's really complicated.
Mm-hmm. The rollout for Medicare back in the day was really bumpy, and people don't remember that now.
Well, the website worked very well then, though.
Oh, yeah, right.
In 1964.
They were having, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Well, the website was much, much, much simpler back then. So, of course.
But you're absolutely right. We forget that these big programs, there's always a few glitches when they roll out. And President Obama has been saying that that's exactly what we're seeing, is we can expect or anticipate that this is not going to go glitch-free with all of the complexities. Thankfully, it's getting better and better.
My favorite part of this is watching not just the glee, but the absolute
giddiness.
The nastiness. Obama's as bad as Hitler because, you know what?
Yeah, yeah.
Bush started a couple of wars based on lies. Obama has a bad website. They're not quite the same thing.
No.
Right.
No.
And it's really interesting because I think that for conservatives, this is a really scary prospect, is to add another component that mm-hmm. actually takes care of individuals. And I think mm-hmm. that's something that we do have to watch this because, let's be honest, Social Security and Medicare, it's in trouble. And, we have to make sure that that's going to stay funded.
But they are beloved.
They you're absolutely right, but yeah. Can we sustain them? Can we afford it? And yet we're adding on another whole program, and I can understand that's got to be concerning.
But what we're seeing though in the industry, and I work in healthcare, is a recent trend is
what
that
the difference is Patty makes people sick.
Yeah, right.
She's on the other side of healthcare.
No, I'm on the IT side, but one of the things that we're seeing though is that hospitals are stepping out there, finding out who their frequent flyers are who don't have insurance, and they're helping them get insurance, and in some cases they're paying the premium every month through the Affordable Care Act, so that they can be covered when they come back in repeatedly to mm-hmm. their facilities.
Right.
And I think that's brilliant. I mean, you think a hospital's paying $200 a month for a patient. Every month, but it's saving them money in the end mm-hmm. because everyone's insured. So,
do you know when the Resource Center first started its insurance coverage program, which I know lots of the patients at AIDS Arms take advantage of? Mm-hmm. The first year Resource Center did it, I think it cost $45,000 for those COBRA policies. The next year it was going to cost $60,000, and so Resource Center went to the county to get the county to fund the $60,000. The original vote was 4-1 against because, as one of the county commissioners said, we don't want to help those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
Said that in public at a commission meeting. And John Wiley Price, I've never seen him better. He said, he called them all bigots, and he said, you saved Parkland Hospital $3 million, or was it $6 million? $6 million based on $45,000. It'll be more this year, and you would rather not fund this program for $60,000 to save $6 million because of who the recipient is.
Yeah, and that's the thing that really gets me about our healthcare system is we really don't practice prevention very well at all. I mean, we do a decent job of treating, but that's way, way behind. And if we're talking about being cost effective, I mean, we just do not do well at prevention.
Yeah.
And I think compared to other nations, we always talk about how our healthcare system fits in with the rest of the nations. We're pretty far at the bottom from developed nations in terms of how well we do in terms of reducing mortality, infant mortality, injury prevention, infectious disease prevention. We just don't do very well at those types of maneuvers.
Mentioning prevention, I think that's a good slide into prevention of HIV.
Let's start with, first of all, just testing.
Testing.
Your agency does testing.
Yep.
The county does testing. The Nelson Thibodeau Clinic does testing. And there are several other places around the city. Plus, you go out into the community, do all kinds of testing. One of the things, though, that I've written about a little bit in the Dallas Voice, and I'm half and half on, is these new home tests. What do you think of them?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, there was a new home test that was approved this past summer, but we've also had a home HIV test that's been available. The old one you had to mail in and mm-hmm. get your results, mm-hmm. but this one, yes, you can get your preliminary results in person. In other words, you get much like a pregnancy test, I guess, you get a preliminary test.
I'm against
test.
Those two.
So
I think if somebody wants to get pregnant, they need to go to the doctor and have it done professionally.
So, kill the rabbit? It used to be done?
No. Just even the getting pregnant part of it.
Get pregnant at the doctor's office.
Exactly.
Yeah. But moving on.
We're off topic here.
The one thing I do want to mention about the home test, it is a tool, and it can be useful in certain circumstances. One of the things I strongly recommend against the home test usage is for serosorting. And,
explain what that means.
Sure. So let's say you've met somebody new. You're out at a bar, and you meet somebody new. You've come home together, and you use the home HIV test as a way to determine whether or not that person that you're going to potentially sleep with is HIV positive or negative. That's probably the worst possible place to use that test because that individual could very well be in the window period and actually be in the most infectious period, and you're going to get that false sense of security.
Right, so during the window period, when you're most contagious, the test is least effective.
Exactly. So that's the wrong place to put it.
Why is that?
Well, because the way the HIV virus starts with its infection period, so as soon as you acquire the infection, the virus starts making millions and millions of copies, and it's only until your body starts ramping up its antibody responses that it can actually reduce the viral load that's circulating around in your system. So at that time, before your body's mounted its immune response, you're incredibly infectious to other people because it's circulating very readily in your blood. So at this, for the same reason that you can't detect the antibodies, which means the test will be negative, is the same reason why somebody that's sort of essentially in that window period is highly infectious.
Okay, now, if you were to get a test at AIDS Arms, you have caseworkers who are right there. If you get a test at the county, you have a caseworker at the county.
Right.
If I'm taking the test at home, do you place caseworkers in my home?
No, no, absolutely not. And, that's the other great point.
Well, why not?
Yeah, we wish we could, but that's the other point is when you get that result, the way we do testing and the way, if you're outside in the medical system getting testing done, you're going to be with somebody that's going to be able to help you immediately talk about those test results, tell you what they mean, and tell you what you need to do next. And we are fearful that if you get the home test and you get a preliminary positive, and it's just that, it's just preliminary, you do have to get confirmation I can't imagine if you're by yourself what you're going to do. I mean, you really need to make sure that those resources are available. Definitely call us, call the health department or resource center, and that those are the places where you'd need to go. But that is the concern about the home test.
Is that why you're kind of against it, David?
Yeah, those are the examples, and I'm not.
I have mixed on this. Yeah, yeah.
I think there are some great uses for it too. Somebody who's regularly tested, or somebody who has been tested and got results back that were negative, but spoke to somebody, if they're not involved in the community already, but somebody who has spoken to a counselor before or generally knows what's available to them. But you get somebody who maybe lives out in the suburbs, somebody who isn't involved in the gay community and therefore probably not the AIDS community, gets these results and they're still thinking back 15 years and it's a death sentence. I'm worried about people doing something drastic as a result.
Right.
Or just not knowing what to do and not knowing where to go. Now, one of the things, those tests do come with great information, resource information, but it's national. And if you call the number, that's something you have to go out of your way to then do. They will refer you to AIDS Arms or Resource Center or one of those places. But so there are good uses for it, though, too.
Well, yeah, I would say, so the way I'd talk about it is it's just another tool in the toolbox. And the key here is that everyone should get an HIV test. The CDC in 2006 really put a position on this, is that everyone in the United States, regardless of what you think your risk factors for HIV acquisition are, should get an HIV test. Now, that home test could be a useful tool for somebody that, for example, doesn't have ongoing access with a medical provider, doesn't feel comfortable when they do see their doctor for their annual exam, and just want to go ahead and get that done and just don't have other resources to do that. So it can be an effective tool to use, but absolutely, it has to be considered for what we just talked about, the places where you definitely don't want to use it, and also the risks when you do use it, that if you do get those test results, you got to figure out what to do
next. If somebody gets an annual HIV test, to do a home test 6 months later in between, I think that's a great use for it. For somebody who isn't near testing facilities but really does understand the ramifications, what he needs to go, great use for it. You had a surprise HIV test.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always gotten tested every other year when I was younger, but now my doctor does it as part of my regular physical, and I guess he started it about 4 years ago, and that was a surprise, because when I called back to get some results for something else, high triglycerides, went down a list, and they're like, oh, your HIV test came back negative. And I'm like, what? I didn't even know I got tested for it. But, I guess, and I asked him about that, and he said, yeah, that's going to – he tests all of his patients as part of his physical. And I had asked you, is that the standard now?
Well, and that's the recommendation, but unfortunately, I don't think it's the standard yet. And so what we really want to do is deliver that message is that really anybody, regardless of risk, should be getting an HIV test in the United States. And unfortunately, we're a far step away from making that happen. Mm-hmm. The biggest challenge and the reason why that's important is in that medical visit. Otherwise, you know, the doctor has to make those ask those tough questions of their patients about whether they're at risk for HIV.
Right.
And then if you're a patient, you have to give that information, and it makes things quite uncomfortable. So mm-hmm. we, you know, think that the best way to handle that is let's just take the risk equation out of it. Mm-hmm. Let's just test everyone. It's a cheap test. It's incredibly accurate. And just get it done. You know, peace of mind.
Well, and there are a lot of people who may be at risk who don't realize it. It's mm-hmm. one of the reasons it's so prevalent now in Africa, is that a lot of men are out, you know, getting infected and bringing it home to their wives, and their wives don't understand that they're at risk because they think, well, I've been married to this man, mm-hmm. it's the only man I'm with, you know, and so that happens here too.
Yeah,
absolutely,
absolutely
it does.
Happens here.
And you know, we're seeing more and more of older individuals coming in who you know you wouldn't expect to have a risk factor for HIV, and unfortunately, what we also see is those individuals tend to be testing really really late. And are already well on the way to AIDS by the time they're getting diagnosed.
I was going to say, late in the stage of HIV.
Yeah, absolutely. Gotcha. So we're really seeing it as missed opportunities. And you know, again, with the treatment that we have, I mean, that's you know, the unfortunate because, you know, we do have abilities to keep the lifespan normal with the drugs that we have.
What do you make of one of my closest friends tested positive, you know, about 10 years ago, and he didn't flip out, didn't freak out, and he's doing really well with his meds. His viral load is undetectable now and so forth, but he kind of made a comment once that, you know, is having HIV now, and I know a lot of people think this, is kind of analogous to having diabetes. It's not that big a deal. It's treatable. You'll be fine. What do you think of that analogy?
Yeah, I know. You know, I'm on both sides of this because on the one hand, that is very true. You know, thankfully, we have great medications that, if taken in the right way, really will render somebody asymptomatic, which means no ill effects due to HIV and a normal lifespan. But what I also see and what really concerns me is that creates complacency. And, you know, one of the things we have to talk about is HIV is more than the medications that you have to take, which is a burden, by the way. You know, you're talking about going to your pharmacist every month, you know, dealing with the cost, co-pays, co-insurance, right, if you're insured, and making sure you keep up with taking a pill a day is, you know, now kind of the case. But there's also a whole thing that you have to do around seeing your doctor and getting your laboratory test done 4 times a year. And so, you know, we worry about the complacency because it is a manageable condition, but we forget, I think, sometimes that management is actually fairly difficult. In fact, we know 45% of those that are in care living with HIV will fall out of care for a year or longer
at wow.
sometime in their disease course.
That's high.
And it's high. And the problem is that what happens, what we see is if people don't feel sick, they don't go to the doctor, right?
Gotcha.
And so we do such a good job with the treatment and the medications. Somebody's feeling well. I don't want to go to the doctor if I'm well. I don't want to take mm-hmm. a half day off of what I'm doing and follow up and deal with labs and costs and all those other things. So, you know, we really do have great medications and treatment, but it does come with a price for the individual. And that's one of the things that we talk about, that we do see the complacency, and we want to make sure people know it's still a condition that has to be treated.
Maybe what people are just not understanding is when they say it's a manageable disease, what the word manageable means, you have to manage it. It's not like, well, this disease has changed and it'll just manage itself. No, you have to manage it. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly here on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink and Laurent Landis, and we'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
In 1972, I was part of a nationwide campaign that came close to getting the U.S. Senate to reject Earl Butz, Richard Nixon's choice for Secretary of Agriculture. A coalition of grassroots farmers, consumers, and public interest organizations teamed up with progressive senators to undertake the almost impossible challenge of defeating the cabinet nominee. The 51-44 Senate vote was so close because we were able to expose Butts as, well, as Butt Ugly. We brought the abusive power of corporate agribusiness into the public consciousness for the first time. We had won a moral victory, but it turned out to be a curse and a blessing. First, the curse. Butts had risen to prominence in the world of agriculture by devoting himself to the corporate takeover of the global food economy. He openly promoted the preeminence of middlemen food manufacturers over family farmers. "Agriculture is no longer a way of life," he barked. "It's a business." He instructed farmers to get big or get out, and proceeded to shove tens of thousands of them out by promoting an export-based, corporate-run food economy. "Adapt," he warned, "or die." "The ruination of farms and rural communities," Butts added, "releases people to do something useful in our society." This is Jim Hightower saying, the curse of Butts, however, spun off a blessing. Small farmers and food artisans practically threw up at the resulting Twinkieization of America's food. They were sickened that nature's own contribution to human culture was being turned into another plasticized product of corporate profiteers. They threw themselves into creating and sustaining a viable alternative, linking locally with consumers, environmentalists, community activists, marketers, and others. The Good Food Rebellion has since sprouted, spread, and blossomed from coast to coast. To find farmers markets and other expressions of this movement right where you live, go to localharvest.org.
Don't be a Scrooge. Give the blues to the music lover on your list. KNON has the perfect CD or LP for you. Texas Blues Radio Volume 5. Texas Blues Radio Volume 5 features acoustic blues, instrumental blues, party songs, somebody done somebody wrong songs, baby got a good thing songs, six-pack and devil's back songs, gumbo, jive, T-bone, and hip-shaking songs from a fine selection of great Texas blues artists. So do right by the blues and give some Texas blues this year. Texas Blues Radio Volume 5 CD is available at KNON.org. Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie, and in Dallas at Bill's Records. Vinyl copies are at Forever Young Records for that vinyl fan on your list. Downloads are available at cdbaby.com. All proceeds are a gift to KNON.
The Dallas Volunteer Attorney Program, a joint initiative of the Dallas Bar Association and Legal Aid of Northwest Texas. It is an organization dedicated to increasing and enhancing pro bono legal services to the poor in Dallas through the recruitment, training, and support of volunteer attorneys. DVAP offers numerous legal clinics for Dallas County residents. For more information, dallasbar.org/DVAP.
This is Alex Hanselka, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM, Dallas.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. It's time for the entertainment report.
All right, everyone knows by now that Time magazine has named Pope Francis as their person of the year. But what you may not be aware of, that there are some runners-up. They had other choices. Mm-hmm. And one of those people was Edith Windsor, who fought back against the Defense of Marriage Act. After her legally wedded wife passed away, Edith faced nearly $400,000 in estate taxes. Edith won her case when the Supreme Court found that a critical section of DOMA is unconstitutional. So, what did you all think about the choice?
I think it's appropriate. I would have picked Edie Windsor just out of, you know, bias.
Of course, but, yeah, same here.
But I think that Pope Francis is in terms of person of the year worldwide. You know, I think that's well placed.
You know, I think he would have been a good runner up. I really liked Edie Windsor, and here's why: what she did has personally affected more people that I know than what the Pope has done. The Pope has made some revolutionary statements. I haven't seen any follow-through, really. I haven't seen any real difference in the Catholic Church yet, because there's such resistance on the level of the cardinals and bishops. I think at a parish level, the priests have always gotten it, but at that hierarchy level, I don't think they'd. But what Edie Windsor did, every day we're hearing new things that they're doing that benefit us. And, it's just had such effect.
I agree.
John, how do you feel?
Any thoughts?
You know, I agree with what you're saying. You know, I think that the Catholic Church has a long ways to go, and there certainly has been progress under Pope Francis. But you know, I think it is an interesting choice given kind of what all is going on in mm-hmm. the Catholic Church. But yeah, I agree that it's an interesting.
One of the runners up was Miley Cyrus, who, you know, if you think about it, she's
really?
Probably the
best. Really?
Yeah. No, he's not joking.
Really?
There's a whole top 10 list, and she's on it, and I'm like, joke?
That just shut down the whole process.
No, but she is on it.
The Pope, Miley Cyrus, I get it.
Wait, and so is Senator Cruz.
Ted Cruz came in fifth, yes.
Yeah, Ted Cruz is on the list also.
Oh, no, no, no. That's bad.
So, it's not all good.
But you know, the Pope has responded. The Pope has responded to being called a Marxist, which mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh and others right. have done. But I think it's sort of a badge of honor for him.
Right.
Because it's not really Lenin, it's Jesus.
Right. Exactly. Ellen took a rare moment to address a tabloid rumor, which she usually does not do on her show, that she and wife Portia de Rossi are about to divorce. Now, as only Ellen can do, the entire addressing of the rumor was a hilarious moment. If you haven't seen it, Google it. It's so funny. As she made it clear that she is very much still happily married, and the only thing that we ever argue about is who loves who more.
Aww.
I thought that was pretty cute. Yeah. So, let's see here. Former Olympian and now reality star Bruce Jenner is no stranger to plastic surgery. If you've seen him lately, you know what I'm talking about. He has confirmed that he is considering to have a cosmetic procedure done called, help me out with this, doctor, a laryngeal shave.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Okay.
Which basically means you a man who has his Adam's apple shaved down. Now, here's what all the hype about this or the speculation is that he is transitioning into a woman. Now, I've heard this rumor about him for a while now that he was really transgender. Mm-hmm. He confirmed.
Well, he is related to the Kardashians.
He is
right?
related to the Kardashians. That's their stepdad. So, mm-hmm. He has said, he did confirm the
procedure.
Their
ratings are down.
Yeah. But he has flat out denied that he is transitioning to a woman. But, you know, they say the only reason why they ever performed that procedure is for someone who's transitioning from a man to a woman. So he says the only reason why he wants to have it, quote, I just never liked my trachea. So I think that's kind of interesting.
I don't have trachea love, but I don't, you know, don't have any negative feelings
about
toward
it.
My
I know.
Trachea.
I thought most men loved having a big Adam's apple.
I didn't think most men thought about it.
Yeah.
Is that is that a medical condition?
No, you got me on this one. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I understand that it's a sort of an LGBT issue with the rumors that he wants to transition, and which I think would be great.
Yeah.
It's fine for everybody. But I hate it when our show tilts Kardashian. I just hate it. for whatever the reason, I hate it. So, thanks, Laron.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
and that's it.
And if I sound like I don't want him to be trans, it's not that I have anything against transgender people.
Oh, I know.
I don't want one of the Kardashians related to the transgender community to give them a bad name.
Exactly.
To give the transgender community a bad name.
To anybody. Yeah. They shouldn't be related to anybody.
I agree.
Anyway, our guest today is John Carlo. He's the new executive director of AIDS ARMS. And we're just talking AIDS treatments, AIDS stuff. You brought along a list of 10 things that are different in HIV care that are just revolutionizing the field. What are some of those things that are just completely different now than the way we used to treat HIV?
Well, the first thing, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, was the home test. In addition to the home test tool, we actually have new technology that it tests and that allows you to get results that lowers the window period, essentially. So we're in the fourth generation of HIV tests, which now says we can detect the presence of HIV within 7 to 10 days after the acquisition of infection. So that's a pretty significant change. You remember in the past, it used to be 3 to 6 months where you'd have to come back and test and you wouldn't know. And now
people would come back, get an indeterminate test, and you had to tell them, well, that probably means you're HIV positive, but you have to come back in 3 months.
Exactly. And so this new technologies have really moved way, way forward in the testing realm. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's really moving forward is we've had a lot in the news about cures for HIV.
Oh yeah.
And we talked about that. There's the Berlin patient, which is what we would call a sterilized cure, and he still is off HIV medications and virologically suppressed. We did read in the news recently that two other cases that received bone marrow transplants did have a recurrence of HIV infection about 18 to 24 months after the procedure. So we've learned that this cure, this what we really want to hope to achieve, is a little more complicated perhaps than what we first thought. But we also did hear in the news this year about a child born in Mississippi who was given highly retroactive antiviral therapy and was rendered also with a presumptive sterilized cure. In other words, that child is no longer on HIV medications.
How old is that child now?
I believe he's now two.
Okay.
And so really has been a good amount of time. And there was a cohort reported out of France, 12 individuals off HIV medications and are undetectable. And so, there are individuals.
What was their treatment?
No treatment. So we think it was a genetic or something that has rendered that situation.
Wow.
The other thing is they were treated very, very early in their disease course, and we're learning more and more that maybe if you're very quick to apply antiretroviral medications that you can actually eradicate the virus before it settles in.
One thing we've known for a long time is that during that window where HIV is extremely active, so is your immune system. And it's just that the immune system over a month, 2 months, 3 months loses.
Right, and it's because that the virus itself attacks the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So you've revved up the immune response, and it does do its job to at least blunt the active viral replication. But yes, eventually the virus goes into the cells and it goes dormant.
So some of these medication or medical treatments might get the immune system to actually work long enough or enough so that it can't attack the immune system.
Oh.
You had something you were going to... Oh, I thought you were...
No, I was just going to ask about what you're talking about where it's undetectable.
Mm-hmm.
Are we still detecting antibodies or has anybody actually detected? Or are we just measuring the response to HIV?
Right. So when you get an HIV test, that test is actually looking for the presence of antibodies. And regardless of what the virus or the number of viral copies that are in your system, it's actually looking for the cells that are fighting that virus. And those will stay, those are always going to remain. So the antibody detection, detection of HIV antibodies always will exist, regardless of what the HIV virus is doing. Now, the viral load test, which essentially is looking for how many copies of virus is actually present in the blood, that can fluctuate, and that's what we want to see undetectable. And so,
so that's what we mean.
That's what we say
says.
when we say undetectable. We
gotcha.
Mean infected with HIV, so mm-hmm. antibody positive. But undetectable means that there's no detection of virus circulating in the blood. Now, one thing I do want to put a sort of caveat to that, that's a very good thing and that's a good outcome. We can't be for sure. We always get asked the question, can you transmit the virus to someone else if you are undetectable? Because that's certainly, and really the answer is we can't say for sure that you are infectious risk free if you are undetectable. It certainly lowers the risk very, very substantially.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't guarantee that you're not going to transmit HIV infection if you are undetectable.
You know what I don't get? I'm going to kind of interrupt our top 10 thing here. It just strikes me so much that young people today and older people who are complacent, as well, the young people who are particular are complacent, don't get is that once you put your toe in this water, it is so complex and it's so much and it's way more, I think, than diabetes. It's there's so much more to know, and there's so much more self-involvement that you have to have. It's so much better for you if you don't ever get it.
Yeah.
Why would you not keep away from that pond? Don't ever put your toe in it. Do everything possible to avoid that and live on with your life. I don't understand why people don't take
that's
that
where,
so seriously.
When you say it's manageable, that's right, it is manageable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the level of management that isn't necessarily comparable.
It will become a lifestyle to be able to deal with all of the things that you have to deal with.
And, you know, to piggyback on what you were saying, not only when you say manage, well, you have to manage it. Well, what else involves in that management, i.e. side effects? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of, especially young people, think you literally pop a pill in the morning and you go on with the rest of your day. Mm-hmm. It's not always that easy.
Right. And I think the other thing is cost. And I think that that's the underlying sort of problem, is that to be able to afford HFA treatment, keep in mind these drugs at retail $1,800 a month for that's for one of the medications that's commonly prescribed. So I think that the big problem with complacency is the lack of understanding of the cost. And the other problem is if you don't have health insurance or you can't afford health insurance, and really that's where agencies like AIDS Arms comes in and applies that support. Thankfully, there is government funding that applies that support, but we're not going to be able to treat our way out of this. And that's what we talk about, is that, you know, we can do a lot of great things with the medications, but we're still seeing roughly 800 new cases a year in Dallas County.
It breaks my heart.
The numbers keep going up.
They could so be doing something about this to prevent.
You know, and you're talking about
this realm.
Federal funding for drugs, and that's called the ADAP program. Mm-hmm. And in Texas, anybody who needs them, luckily, is on the ADAP program. You go to a state like Florida, and they have a waiting list of like 5,000 people. Texas has no waiting list, which is great. But there are co-infections, mm-hmm. like hepatitis C. And there is no Ryan White program for hepatitis C. There is no ADAP program for hepatitis C. So if you have hepatitis C, you better have insurance, or you have to get onto an experimental regimen that's working on curing it. And Hep C seems to be curable right now, but who can afford that?
Right. Yeah, and that's
and
that's
your insurance company is not going to pay for it, since it's not an approved drug regimen.
The hepatitis C is just, you know, first of all, the number that are living with hepatitis C is about 10 times higher than that are living with HIV. So we have a huge hepatitis C problem in this country. And just like you said, the only people that can get treatment are those that can afford to get care. And while the other thing that's happened is we've got some great news with treatment. There was a new drug just recently released that has amazing cure rates. But that drug is somewhere in the $40,000 or $50,000 range, you know, and so these medications are extraordinarily expensive, and so we're getting again this paradox where we have the treatments that are available, but we have the community that's not going to be able to afford those drugs, and so what are we going to do?
And there's a huge co-infection rate between people with HIV and Hep C.
Yeah, the co-infection rate can be as high as 30%. So, wow. You know, and that's something that at AIDS Arms we're contending with. We do see a lot of hepatitis C. Thankfully, we have NIH-sponsored research studies, as you mentioned, that really offers treatment options for individuals. Mm-hmm. But for the vast majority of those that are living with HIV, that are living with hepatitis C, first, they don't even know it that they're living with. And secondly, finding those treatment options are very limited.
Yeah.
I just think it would just be crazy for folks today not to try to put all of their energy and effort, all that they would be doing in managing some future infection, put that energy today and every day and every moment and not getting it. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have to deal with all of this cycle of, you know, feeling good and feeling bad, having money, not having money, having a job, not having a job, having insurance, not having insurance. I mean, it's just crazy, and you would just live without dealing with that. You could just prevent it.
I.e. prevention, which when we come back, I know we're about to take a break.
We'll talk about that.
Can we talk about PrEP?
Sure.
And you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I am Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink and Laron Landis. Our guest is Dr. John Carlo, the executive director of AIDS Arms. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
KNON thanks you for your pledge to our recent pledge drive. Now is the time to make your pledge count. Be sure to send it in to KNON 5353 Maple Avenue, Dallas, Texas 75235. If you missed our pledge drive, you can still support community radio by donating online at KNON.org. Your pledge only counts if you pay it. KNON 5353 Maple Avenue, Dallas, Texas 75235. Be sure to include the name of the show you're supporting. For questions about the pledge drive, 214-828-9500, extension 234.
This is a random person, and I don't listen to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM Dallas.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink and Laron Landis. John Carlos, our guest, he's the executive director of AIDS Arms. We were just talking about some of the new ways that HIV is being managed, cared for. What are some of those other type things that we're doing?
So another one is, and this is somewhat controversial, is the pre-exposure prophylaxis, and that's called PrEP. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding is if you take two of the three commonly used anti-HIV drugs and you're not infected and you take those regularly, you can actually prevent the acquisition of infection. And they've had some very good studies that actually show that to be the case over a large population. So we are confident that the science at least says that is a good tool to use. Now, the problem with that is how do we use that tool in the real world? And this goes back to that complexity of treatment and care, because if you are going to go on PrEP, we have to monitor your labs just like you do if you're living with HIV, because the drugs that you would take do have kidney side effects primarily, so you're going to have to get a laboratory test at least every 6 months. And as well, you have to get HIV tests every 6 months, because we need to make sure you don't actually get the infection while you're on the medication. So PrEP can be a tool. There certainly are some applications for perhaps somebody that is not going to be able to do the normal preventive things, such as using condoms and practicing safe sex. It certainly is a useful tool, but it's got to be done in the context of the broader healthcare that's required to go on behind that. And the last thing I'll mention on that is these drugs are expensive. And even if you have insurance, a lot of insurance companies are going to require what's called a prior authorization, which means your doctor will have to fill out a form and sign it every time you get a prescription refill, which will be monthly. So a lot of demand in order to keep up with that, which makes it very hard to do.
Who should take PrEP?
Well, I think it really has to be individual between a physician and that patient. And so really, I guess if I had a patient that was interested in PrEP, I would be very carefully counseling that patient about what is causing the risk factors. And, you know, one of the things, examples, you know, perhaps maybe a young gay man that you know, is constantly getting sexually transmitted infections, even though we've been working through that risk, and it's just not.
He's talking about you, Laron.
Yeah, it's just not working. Over and over. And so the last thing you do if you're seeing that, you do have this tool, and that would be the time where you might have to put that tool into place. But if I was going to do it, you would have to have a very strong conversation with the individual. You'd have to see them regularly. You'd have to manage. And you know, the prevention issues don't stop. So in other words, just because you're going to start taking PrEP does not mean you don't wear a condom anymore.
Right, exactly.
You know, so no doctor is going to, you know, give you the free rein to do that.
So this you can't compare this to, like, just taking a pill to prevent pregnancy.
Right, absolutely not. So there really is some good reasons why you would do it, because if, you know, of course, if you can prevent an infection, that's going to be, and a lot of times, you know, particularly in perhaps a young male as an example, before he settles down and you know, goes into a monogamous relationship, you know, this is maybe just a temporary phase in his life, and you don't want, you know, HIV to become part of that phase. And so
I'd
there
be
are
a good example of somebody who would be a likely candidate, because we're a serodiscordant couple. And especially as we were first getting together, would be a time where maybe for 6 months you would go on. But I like my kidneys. And
right.
You like your trachea and you like your kidneys?
I like my trachea, I like my kidneys, and I just didn't want to go on PrEP, I decided.
Right. Right. Yeah, and that,
we'll do other things.
That's another good example, though. Serodiscordant couples is another place. But again, you know, you have to look at it as a lifelong question. And so, just like you mentioned, maybe the first 6 months could be a good option.
Right. You know, and talk about HIV being a manageable disease. Here it's a manageable, I don't have the disease yet. So really managing that is really peculiar.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the complacency. I think we've done such a good job with treatment is we don't visually, thankfully, see what was in the 80s, mm-hmm. which was just death. Mm-hmm. And without that very visual place in our communities, we are seeing complacency.
Right. I don't want to digress a little bit from what HIV, the treatment for HIVs are. You know, we talked about the bone marrow transplant and, you know, how that has taken how that has turned out. Just recently in the news, I heard that I think it was a girl who was purposely infected with HIV to treat a cancer. Have you heard about that?
I can't see. I remember that story. You know, one of the things that we're learning more and more, you know, with the HIV research is how much, you know, crossover there's been in the discoveries around HIV. You know, keep in mind that before 1981, HIV was a class of viruses we really didn't even know existed. And we joke that the infectious disease textbook went from, you know, a manageable volume to now, you know, a large, you know, treaty of information. And there's been innovations in cancer research thanks to HIV research, like melanoma treatments is an example and things like that. So there is crossover applications. Okay. Now, I'm not familiar with that specific case, but, you know, I think that what we're finding is that, you know, when we're doing this research, we've really come a long way with the medications, the testing that we've been talking about. But there has been other applications that we've been able to benefit and from that.
The way I understand that one is they're using the HIV virus, which is so effective in drilling into the T cell, mm-hmm. to use that part of the HIV virus to drill into the cancer cells. And somehow they're genetically engineering it, and that goes above my science.
It's fascinating.
There are so many. You know, I think that scientific discovery is absolutely amazing when they come across these innovative ways, especially when there are applications that you would not suspect to be the best way forward. And, you know, a lot of these things kind of either happen by accident or, you know, cross pollination, mm-hmm. from different disciplines. And I think that's a good example that you're bringing up.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other things on?
Some of the other things that we're hoping to see very soon, generic medications for HIV. Now, worldwide.
Wow.
I think Gilead should have should get it all.
Because it's expensive.
And we should extend their patents. I like that we're paying $1,800 for a pill that costs them about $1.50 to produce.
If all right. Cheaper than that.
we'll go on with that. I will say that.
Welcome to David.
Right, but now what you may or may not agree with me on.
Being sarcastic.
Well, I know
by
that.
The way.
I know. But worldwide, what they've done, you know, and now granted, we pay for it here in the U.S., mm-hmm. but thankfully, it's not nearly expensive in developing nations to get HIV care.
Well, aren't there a few countries like Brazil and India that tried to negotiate with some of the drug manufacturers here, couldn't get anywhere near getting anything that was reasonable, and so they just said, patent doesn't apply in our country.
I think a lot of that has changed in the last couple of years particularly. I mean, I think that we do have treatment options now that are affordable. Now, I mean, there's still some tremendous challenges to get access and have everyone that needs HIV medications around the world on treatment. But I do think that there has been some movement in that area. And I think, you know, we are going to finally hopefully get to some point where we get past the patent period and really we hope for generic medications. It's not going to be as designed as good as it, you know, because we're now talking about one pill once a day regimens. Those aren't going to be generic anytime soon. But, you know, that, for example, Atripla, that's three drugs, you know, some of those might be coming off patent in the next couple of years, and you could take three pills instead of the one all at the same time. So
at an affordable price.
At an affordable price, which is the main thing, because, you know, I think that the cost of treatment is really what's driving, you know, unfortunately, the cost of HIV care. And so as soon as we can get the drugs...
The cost of treatment is part of what's driving the HIV rate up.
Yeah.
Not that I would ever accuse the drug companies of wanting us to do that, because I just would... That's just not like me to say something like that.
Because they would never do something like that.
They would never do something like that.
What do you have to say about...
Corporate profits.
Of course, you know, a lot of conspiracy theorists out there who just will not give up and say that there is a cure already existing. not, you know, a functioning cure, and they always bring up the example of Magic Johnson.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I say is that, yes, I think we do have a cure already, but we're already using it. And what that cure is that the medications we have can render an individual virologically suppressed throughout his or her life. And that, to me, is pretty close to a cure. So now, to most, though, that's not really a cure. I think what we want more than that is to go off medications and remain virologically suppressed. And there has been some developments in looking for ways to do that. But I don't think that there is a hidden conspiracy behind the scenes to prevent that from happening. I think we do have, we've made amazing strides. You know, to keep in mind, it was only in 1996 when we really only had a few drugs, and now we're over 35 medications that are FDA approved. Mm-hmm. So I think that really are moving quicker and quicker down the road in enabling better and better treatment options.
And the other thing about better treatment options are they do keep working on these medications that have fewer side effects. You were talking before about kidney damage,
right.
But the latest version of Truvada is really much less likely to cause kidney damage than the early versions of it.
Right, and that's actually one of the things that AIDS Arms were working on with an NIH study, is to specifically look at some of the new changes in these drugs that can allow less side effect risk, particularly on the kidneys.
You do realize after this show, no drug company will work with AIDS Arms again.
we have all takers, so we definitely have drug partners. But I will say that we also, most of our research is NIH funded, and we're not on pharma by any means. Mm-hmm. We're doing what's best for our patients, and you know, offering care and treatment and research to enable the best care is what we do.
You talked about how in city of, or Dallas County, the numbers continue to rise. Do you know of any cities, countries that seem to be getting it right and the numbers are lowering?
You know, it was interesting. There was this new study out of Australia that just does some amazing work. And I think that, you know, every country is different, of course. But one of the things they have is a very strong registry of all tests. So they really know, who's living with HIV. So they have a good sense of numbers. And they also have trended that over time. One of the things they're looking at now is if they use treatment as prevention. In other words, as soon as somebody's testing positive, they put them on medications regardless of CD4 count, and that's really becoming the new way to treat. There are some designs in their system, at least, that shows they could effectively reduce the new infection rate by 35% to 40% through a treatment as prevention, and it would be cost effective. In other words, those extra medications that would be applied perhaps years earlier than is still in a cost effective way.
If somebody else doesn't
right,
contract
exactly,
it.
So, exactly. Yeah. And also prevents all the other, you know, comorbidities, co-infections and things like that. I think different countries are doing different things in terms of, and they're experiencing different successes. Of course, we're not the same as Australia. Our epidemic is not the same. And so we kind of have to look at what, you know, we can certainly look at as a practice, but there's certainly some differences between our nations.
I have a quick question about this treatment regimen, and I'm speaking in terms of side effects and costs and outcomes and all of those things. Are there big differences between what happens or the effects upon women versus men and upon adults versus children? Are there big splits in those?
Right, and they... You know, one of the things that I have heard over the years is that there has not been as many studies on women in the treatment success. I think that they are finding that they're the same, but I think your question on the side effects probably hasn't been as well studied as it possibly could be. I think as a whole, from what we see, it's very similar. But, you know, really there may be some differences there that we can pick up through better studies. So it's a very good point. And we've also looked at in terms of race and which medications could be better for different people. But again, those are sort of in development now, and there's no firm data on that.
What else is on your
list? What else? I think the other thing that's new, and there's two really kind of the new paradigms that we're talking about, and one of them is really sort of how do we make effective treatment options for patients? And I think one of the big things that I've seen is that, you know, okay, so if we want to ensure effective patient care. They stay with us. They're linked to care. They're retention into care. They're staying on medications, even though they're well. What's the incentive? Right. I mean, and really, the incentive, of course, from public health is big. I mean, it's huge. The more we can keep people in treatment, the less infections are going to be transmitted, the less likely we're going to see.
Well, and for the patient, it's his life.
And it's his life or her life. But, you know, sometimes those choices aren't immediately apparent because life is life, you know, mm-hmm. and so it may not be the first priority on his or her life. One of the things that's becoming more and more looked at is further incentivizing care. And so, you know, what about rewarding patients for staying in care? And so there's some new concepts that says that actually can be a good way to keep people in care. And again, it's cost effective because if you keep people sustained on medications, yes, you have to give maybe a monetary reward. And, you know, I mean, we might have some ethical dilemmas about that. But in the end game, which is really public health, it's of benefit. So there's some new paradigms, I think, in how we deliver HIV care that's going to be kind of new and cutting edge in the future.
I would like to see, I mean, rather than, I would say, reward someone for staying in care, is just to make it, you know, less burdensome. I mean, to me, if I were one of those patients, not, you know, I've been constantly, at moments in time, ill. I'm not able to go to work, and so maybe I'm going to lose my job, and then I'm going to lose my, if I lose my job, I'm losing my insurance, and now it's going to be a huge financial burden on me to maintain my medications. You know, just make it easier for me to get them, and then I'll stay on them, and then I won't get sick and lose my job and all these things, lose my insurance. I mean, to me, that's a better way to go, but not all people think that way.
Well, no, I see your point, but also that goes back to his point earlier that some patients, when they are starting to do well, then they just stop going. You know, so
I don't need to do that anymore.
I don't need to do that anymore. So.
Right. But I will say you make a great point, and that we at AIDS Arms, we make a specific charge to make sure that first medical visit can be done as seamlessly as possible. And, you know, we talked about getting new diagnoses, like at the county health department, for example. We have a case manager on site who can help really introduce the medical care option, and we can get a first visit within 2 weeks, which we find is incredibly important to keeping linkage into care, making it as easy as possible for an individual to get into their first appointment. So I think you're absolutely right. We have to reduce those barriers that do prevent an individual from accessing care. And you know, barriers are pretty big for people. If we talked a lot about cost, but for many living with HIV, it's transportation. Mm-hmm. Or it's food, it's housing, you know, and you know, so there are big barriers out there against the broader picture of what the needs in the community are that we have to kind of recognize. We can't just treat the HIV in isolation. It won't work. And so we really have to have that comprehensive view of really where those barriers are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of people, their first care is at, we'll call it Mercy Hospital, as they do in the Dallas Buyers Club. They were trying to avoid a lawsuit, too. And my partner was going to Mercy Hospital. We went to pick up his drugs one time, waited online 3 hours. So I said, we're not doing this again. And, oh, I have to. You don't have to. I made an appointment for him over at AIDS Arms, and he missed the appointment even. You know, it's like, and he knows better, right? He missed the appointment. We happened to be out somewhere in Oak Lawn, saw Gene Voskuhl, who's the doctor at Trinity, your health care...
medical director.
Yeah, he's the medical director. And I said, I want to introduce you to your new patient. And he missed his appointment. And Gene just said, oh, okay, when do you want to come? I'll just, when I get back to the office, I'll just change that appointment. It was that easy. You know, that's such a perfect example. Brian went to his appointment, and he came home, and he said, that's the first time I saw a doctor in 7 years.
Wow.
So wow. That's the difference. And that's a perfect example of getting rid of barriers. So, are we out of time?
We're out of time.
Oh, it's 2:00. Well, that brings us to the end of another Lambda
Weekly. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you
for having me.
Thank you, and come back.
Delightful. Thank you very much.
We'll see you next week.